This is Randy Wasserstrom with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome you to our readings from Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. With me today is Susie Pratt, who will be reading the actual diary entries written by Anne. This show is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Feel free to call us with any comments or questions about this show or any other subject pertaining to Triangle Radio Reading Service. We're here to serve our listeners, and your input will help us to do a better job. The number is 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. You can also visit our website at www.trianglereadingservice.org. Thanks again for joining us.
Wednesday, May 10th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, we were sitting in the attic yesterday afternoon working on our French when suddenly I heard the splatter of water behind me. I asked Peter what it might be. Without pausing to reply, he dashed up to the loft, the scene of the disaster, and shoved Mushi, who was squatting beside her soggy litter box, back to the right place. This was followed by shouts and squeals, and then Mushi, who by that time had finished peeing, took off downstairs. In search of something similar to her box, Mushi had found herself a pile of wood shavings right over a crack in the floor. The puddle immediately trickled down to the attic, and as luck would have it, landed in and next to the potato barrel. The ceiling was dripping, and since the attic floor has also got its share of cracks, little yellow drops were leaking through the ceiling and onto the dining table, between a pile of stockings and books. I was doubled up with laughter. It was such a funny sight. There was Mushi crouched under a chair, Peter armed with water, powdered bleach, and a cloth, and Mr. Van Dan trying to calm everybody down. The room was soon set to rights, but it's a well-known fact that cat puddles stink to high heaven. The potatoes proved that all too well, as did the wood shavings, which Father collected in a bucket and brought downstairs to burn. Poor Mushi. How were you to know it's impossible to get peep for your box? Anne. Thursday, May 11th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, a new sketch to make you laugh. Peter's hair had to be cut, and as usual, his mother was to be the hairdresser. At 7:25, Peter vanished into his room and reappeared at the stroke of 7:30, stripped down to his blue swimming trunks and a pair of tennis shoes. "Are you coming?" he asked his mother. "Yes, I'll be up in a minute, but I can't find the scissors." Peter helped her look, rummaging around in her cosmetics drawer. "Don't make such a mess, Peter," she grumbled. I didn't catch Peter's reply, but it must have been insolent, because she cuffed him on the arm. He cuffed her back. She punched him with all her might, and Peter pulled his arm away with a look of mock horror on his face. "Come on, old girl." Mrs. Van D stayed put. Peter grabbed her by the wrists and pulled her all around the room. She laughed, cried, scolded, and kicked, but nothing helped. Peter led his prisoner as far as the attic stairs, where he was obliged to let go of her. Mrs. Van D came back to the room and collapsed into a chair with a loud sigh. "Die Entführung der Mutter," I joked. "The Abduction of Mother," a possible reference to Mozart's opera, The Abduction from the Seraglio. "Yes, but he hurt me." I went to have a look and cooled her hot red wrists with water. Peter, still by the stairs and growing impatient again, strode into the room with his belt in his hand, like a lion tamer. Mrs. Vandy didn't move, but stayed by her writing desk, looking for a handkerchief. "You've got to apologize first." "All right. I hereby offer my apologies, but only because if I don't, we'll be here till midnight." Mrs. Vandy had to laugh in spite of herself. She got up and went toward the door, where she felt obliged to give us an explanation. By us, I mean Father, Mother, and me. We were busy doing the dishes. "He wasn't like this at home," she said. "I'd have belted him so hard, he'd have gone flying down the stairs. He's never been so insolent. This isn't the first time he deserved a good hiding. That's what you get with a modern upbringing, modern children. I'd never have grabbed my mother like that. Did you treat your mother that way, Mr. Frank? She was very upset, pacing back and forth, saying whatever came into her head, and she still hadn't gone upstairs. Finally, at long last, she made her exit. Less than 5 minutes later, she stormed back down the stairs with her cheeks all puffed out and flung her apron on the chair. When I asked if she was through, she replied that she was going downstairs. She tore down the stairs like a tornado, probably straight into the arms of her putti. She didn't come up again until 8, this time with her husband. Peter was dragged from the attic, given a merciless scolding, and showered with abuse. Ill-mannered brat, no good bum, bad example, and this, Margot that. I could hear the rest. Everything seems to have calmed down again today. Yours, Anne M. Frank. P.S. Tuesday and Wednesday evening, our beloved queen addressed the country. She's taking a vacation, so she'll be in good health for her return to the Netherlands. She used words like, soon when I'm back in Holland, a swift liberation, heroism, and heavy burdens. This was followed by a speech by Prime Minister Gerbrandy. He has such a squeaky little child's voice that Mother instinctively said, ooh. A clergyman, who must have borrowed his voice from Mr. Edel, concluded by asking God to take care of the Jews, all those in concentration camps and prisons, and everyone working in Germany. Thursday, May 11th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, since I've left my entire junk box, including my fountain pen, upstairs, and I'm not allowed to disturb the grown-ups during their nap time until 2:30, you'll have to make do with a letter in pencil. I'm terribly busy at the moment, and strange as it may sound, I don't have enough time to get through my pile of work. Shall I tell you briefly what I've got to do? Well then, before tomorrow, I have to finish reading the first volume of a biography of Galileo Galilei, since it has to be returned to the library. I started reading it yesterday and have gotten up to page 220 out of 320. So I'll manage it. Next week I have to read Palestine at the Crossroads and the second volume of Galilee. Besides that, I finished the first volume of a biography of Emperor Charles V yesterday, and I still have to work out the many genealogical charts I've collected and the notes I've taken. Next, I have 3 pages of foreign words from my various books, all of which have to be written down, memorized, and read aloud. Number 4, my movie stars are in a terrible disarray and are dying to be straightened out, but since it'll take several days to do that, and Professor Anne is, as she's already said, up to her ears in work, they'll have to put up with the chaos a while longer. Then, there's Theseus, Oedipus, Peleus, Orpheus, Jason, and Hercules all waiting to be untangled, since their various deeds are running crisscross through my mind like multicolored threads in a dress. Myron and Phidias are also urgently in need of attention, or else I'll forget entirely how they fit into the picture. The same applies, for example, to the Seven Years' War, the Nine Years' War. Now I'm getting everything all mixed up. Well, what can you do with a memory like mine? Just imagine how forgetful I'll be when I'm 80. Oh, one more thing. The Bible. How long is it going to take before I come to the story of the bathing Susanna? And what do they mean by Sodom and Gomorrah? Oh, that's still so much to find out and learn. And in the meantime, I've left Charlotte of the Palatin in the lurch. You can see, can't you, Kitty, that I'm full to bursting. And now something else. You've known for a long time that my greatest wish is to be a journalist, and later on, a famous writer. We'll have to wait and see if these grand illusions, or delusions, will ever come true. But up to now, I've had no lack of topics. In any case, after the war, I'd like to publish a book called The Secret Annex. It remains to be seen whether I'll succeed, but my diary can serve as the basis. I also need to finish Katie's life. I've thought up the rest of the plot. After being cured in the sanatorium, Katie goes back home and continues writing to Hans. It's 1941, and it doesn't take her long to discover Hans' Nazi sympathies, and since Katie is deeply concerned with the plight of the Jews and of her friend Marianne, they begin drifting apart. They meet and get back together, but break up when Hans takes up with another girl. Katie is shattered, and because she wants to have a good job, she studies nursing. After graduation, she accepts a position, at the urging of her father's friends, as a nurse in a TB sanatorium in Switzerland. During her first vacation, she goes to Lake Como, where she runs into Hans. He tells her that 2 years earlier he'd married Katie's successor, but that his wife took her life in a fit of depression. Now that he's seen his little Katie again, he realizes how much he loves her, and once more asks for her hand in marriage. Katie refuses, even though, in spite of herself, she loves him as much as ever. But her pride holds her back. Hans goes away, and years later, Katie learns that he's wound up in England, where he's struggling with ill health. When she's 27, Katie marries a well-to-do man from the country named Simon. She grows to love him, but not as much as Hans. She has two daughters and a son, Elton, Judith, and Nico. She and Simon are happy together, but Hans is always in the back of her mind, until one night she dreams of him and says farewell. It's not sentimental nonsense. It's based on the story of Father's life. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, May 13th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, yesterday was Father's birthday, Father and Mother's 19th wedding anniversary, a day without the cleaning lady, and the sun was shining as it's never shone before in 1944. Our chestnut tree is in full bloom. It's covered with leaves and is even more beautiful than last year. Father received a biography of Linnaeus from Mr. Kleiman, a book on nature from Mr. Kugler, the canals of Amsterdam from Dussel, a huge box from the Van Dans wrapped so beautifully it might have been done by a professional, containing 3 eggs, a bottle of beer, a jar of yogurt, and a green tie. It made our jar of molasses seem rather paltry. My roses smelled wonderful compared to Miep and Bep's red carnations. He was thoroughly spoiled. 50 petits fours arrived from Siemens Bakery. Delicious! Father also treated us to spice cake, the men to beer, and the ladies to yogurt. Everything was scrumptious. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Tuesday, May 16th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, just for a change, since we haven't had one of these in so long, I'll recount a little discussion between Mr. and Mrs. Van D. last night. Mrs. Van D. The Germans have had plenty of time to fortify the Atlantic Wall, and they'll certainly do everything within their power to hold back the British. It's amazing how strong the Germans are. Mr. Van D. Oh, yes, amazing. Mrs. Van D. It is! Mr. Van D. They are so strong, they're bound to win the war in the end. Is that what you mean? Mrs. Van D. They might. I'm not convinced that they won't. Mr. Van D. I won't even answer that. Mrs. Van D. You always wind up answering. You let yourself get carried away every single time. Mr. Van D. No, I don't. I always keep my answers to the bare minimum. Mrs. Van D. But you always do have an answer, and you always have to be right. Your predictions hardly ever come true, you know. Mr. Van D. So far they have. Mrs. Van D. No, they haven't. You said the invasion was going to start last year. The Finns were supposed to have been out of the war by now. The Italian campaign ought to have been over by last winter, and the Russians should already have captured Lemberg. Oh, no. I don't set much store by your predictions. Mr. Van D., leaping to his feet. Why don't you shut your trap for a change? I'll show you who's right. Someday you'll get tired of needling me. I can't stand your belly aching a minute longer. Just wait. One day I'll make you eat your words. Actually, I couldn't help giggling. Mother couldn't either, and even Peter was biting his lips to keep from laughing. Oh, those stupid grown-ups. They need to learn a few things first before they start making so many remarks about the younger generation. Since Friday, we've been keeping the windows open again at night. Yours, Anne M. Frank. What our annex family is interested in. a systematic survey of courses and reading matter. Mr. Van Dan, no courses. Looks up many things in NAR's encyclopedia and lexicon. Likes to read detective stories, medical books, and love stories, exciting or trivial. Mrs. Van Dan, a correspondence course in English. Likes to read biographical novels and occasionally other kinds of novels. Mr. Frank, is learning English, Dickens, and a bit of Latin. Never reads novels, but likes serious, rather dry descriptions of people and places. Mrs. Frank, a correspondence course in English, reads everything except detective stories. Mr. Dussel is learning English, Spanish, and Dutch with no noticeable results. Reads everything, goes along with the opinion of the majority. Peter Van Dan is learning English, French, correspondence course, shorthand in Dutch, English, and German, commercial correspondence in English, woodworking, economics, and sometimes math. Seldom reads, sometimes geography. Margot Frank, correspondence courses in English, French, and Latin, shorthand in English, German, and Dutch, trigonometry, solid geometry, mechanics, physics, chemistry, algebra, geometry, English literature, French literature, German literature, Dutch literature, bookkeeping, geography, modern history, biology, economics. Reads everything, preferably on religion and medicine. Anne Frank, shorthand in French, English, German, and Dutch, geometry, algebra, history, geography, art history, mythology, biology, Bible history, Dutch literature, likes to read biographies, dull or exciting, and history books, sometimes novels and light reading. Friday, May 19th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, I felt rotten yesterday. Vomiting, and that from Anne. Headache, stomach ache, and anything else you can imagine. I'm feeling better today. I'm famished. But I think I'll skip the brown beans we're having for dinner. Everything's going fine between Peter and me. The poor boy has an even greater need for tenderness than I do. He still blushes every evening when he gets his goodnight kiss, and then begs for another one. Am I merely a better substitute for Bosch? I don't mind. He's so happy just knowing somebody loves him. After my laborious conquest, I've distanced myself a little from the situation, but you mustn't think my love has cooled. Peter's a sweetheart. But I've slammed the door to my inner self. If he ever wants to force the lock again, he'll have to use a harder crowbar. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, May 20th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, last night when I came down from the attic, I noticed, the moment I entered the room, that the lovely vase of carnations had fallen over. Mother was down on her hands and knees mopping up the water, and Margot was fishing my papers off the floor. What happened? I asked with anxious foreboding, and before they could reply, I assessed the damage from across the room. My entire genealogy file, my notebooks, my books, everything was afloat. I nearly cried, and I was so upset I started speaking German. I can't remember a word, but according to Margot, I babbled something like, incalculable loss, terrible, awful, irreplaceable, and much more. Father burst out laughing, and Mother and Margot joined in, but I felt like crying because all my work and elaborate notes were lost. I took a closer look, and luckily, the incalculable loss wasn't as bad as I'd expected. Up in the attic, I carefully peeled apart the sheets of paper that were stuck together and then hung them on the clothesline to dry. It was such a funny sight, even I had to laugh. Maria de Medici alongside Charles V, William of Orange, and Marie Antoinette. It's Rassenschande, Mr. Van Dan joked, an affront to racial purity. After entrusting my papers to Peter's care, I went back downstairs. Which books are ruined? I asked Margot, who was going through them. Algebra, Margot said. But as luck would have it, my algebra book wasn't entirely ruined. I wish it had fallen right into the vase. I've never loathed any book as much as that one. Inside the front cover are the names of at least 20 girls who had it before I did. It's old, yellowed, full of scribbles, crossed out words and revisions. The next time I'm in a wicked mood, I'm going to tear the darn thing to pieces. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Monday, May 22nd, 1944. Dearest Kitty, on May 20th, Father lost his bet and had to give 5 jars of yogurt to Mrs. Van Dan. The invasion still hasn't begun. I can safely say that all of Amsterdam, all of Holland, in fact, the entire western coast of Europe, all the way down to Spain, are talking about the invasion day and night, debating, making bets, and hoping. The suspense is rising to fever pitch. By no means has everyone we think of as good Dutch people kept their faith in the English. Not everyone thinks the English bluff is a masterful strategical move. Oh no, people want deeds, great, heroic deeds. No one can see farther than the end of their nose. No one gives a thought to the fact that the British are fighting for their own country and their own people. Everyone thinks it's England's duty to save Holland as quickly as possible. What obligations do the English have toward us? What have the Dutch done to deserve the generous help they so clearly expect? Oh no, the Dutch are very much mistaken. The English, despite their bluff, are certainly no more to blame for the war than all the other countries, large and small, that are now occupied by the Germans. The British are not about to offer their excuses. True, they were sleeping during the years Germany was rearming itself. But all the other countries, especially those bordering on Germany, were asleep too. England and the rest of the world have discovered that burying your head in the sand doesn't work, and now each of them, especially England, is having to pay a heavy price for its ostrich policy. No country sacrifices its men without reason, and certainly not in the interests of another, and England is no exception. The invasion, liberation, and freedom will come someday. Yet England, not the occupied territories, will choose the moment. To our great sorrow and dismay, we've heard that many people have changed their attitude toward us Jews. We've been told that anti-Semitism has cropped up in circles where once it would have been unthinkable. This fact has affected us all very, very deeply. The reason for the hatred is understandable, maybe even human, but that doesn't make it right. According to the Christians, the Jews are blabbing their secrets to the Germans, denouncing their helpers, and causing them to suffer the dreadful fate and punishments that have already been meted out to so many. All of this is true, but as with everything, they should look at the matter from both sides. Would Christians act any differently if they were in our place? Could anyone, regardless of whether they're Jews or Christians, remain silent in the face of German pressure? Everyone knows it's practically impossible, so why do they ask the impossible of the Jews? It's being said in underground circles that the German Jews who immigrated to Holland before the war and have now been sent to Poland shouldn't be allowed to return here. They were granted the right to asylum in Holland, but once Hitler is gone, they should go back to Germany. When you hear that, you begin to wonder why we're fighting this long and difficult war. We're always being told that we're fighting for freedom, truth, and justice. The war isn't even over, and already there's dissension, and Jews are regarded as lesser beings. Oh, it's sad. Very sad that the old adage has been confirmed for the umpteenth time. What one Christian does is his own responsibility. What one Jew does reflects on all Jews. To be honest, I can't understand how the Dutch, a nation of good, honest, upright people, can sit in judgment on us the way they do. On us, the most oppressed, unfortunate, and pitiable people in all the world. I have only one hope, that this anti-Semitism is just a passing thing, that the Dutch will show their true colors, that they'll never waver from what they know in their hearts to be just. For this is unjust. And if they ever carry out this terrible threat, the meager handful of Jews still left in Holland will have to go. we too will have to shoulder our bundles and move on. Away from this beautiful country, which once so kindly took us in and now turns its back on us. I love Holland. Once I hoped it would become a fatherland to me since I had lost my own. And I hope so still. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Thursday, May 25th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, Bep's engaged. The news isn't much of a surprise, though none of us are particularly pleased. Bertus may be a nice, steady, athletic young man, but Bep doesn't love him. And to me, that's enough reason to advise her against marrying him. Bep's trying to get ahead in the world, and Bertus is pulling her back. He's a laborer, without any interest or desire to make something of himself. I don't think that'll make Bep happy. I can understand Bep's wanting to put an end to her indecision. 4 weeks ago, she decided to write him off, but then she felt even worse. So she wrote him a letter, and now she's engaged. There are several factors involved in this engagement. First, Bep's sick father, who likes Bertus very much. Second, she's the oldest of the Voskuil girls, and her mother teases her about being an old maid. Third, she's just turned 24, and that matters a great deal to Bep. Mother said it would have been better if Bep had simply had an affair with Bertus. I don't know. I feel sorry for Bep and can understand her loneliness. In any case, they can get married only after the war, since Bertus is in hiding, or at any rate has gone underground. Besides, they don't have a penny to their name and nothing in the way of a hope chest. What a sorry prospect for Bep, for whom we all wish the best. I only hope Bertus improves under her influence, or that Bep finds another man, one who knows how to appreciate her. Yours, Anne M. Frank. The same day. There's something happening every day. This morning, Mr. Van Hoven was arrested. He was hiding two Jews in his house. It's a heavy blow for us, not only because those poor Jews are once again balancing on the edge of an abyss, but also because it's terrible for Mr. Van Hoven. The world's been turned upside down. The most decent people are being sent to concentration camps, prisons, and lonely cells, while the lowest of the low rule over young and old, rich and poor. One gets caught for black marketeering, another for hiding Jews or other unfortunate souls. Unless you're a Nazi, you don't know what's going to happen to you from one day to the next. Mr. Van Hoven is a great loss to us, too. Bep can't possibly lug such huge amounts of potatoes all the way here, nor should she have to, so our only choice is to eat fewer of them. I'll tell you what we have in mind, but it's certainly not going to make life here any more agreeable. Mother says we'll skip breakfast, eat hot cereal and bread for lunch, and fried potatoes for dinner, and, if possible, vegetables or lettuce once or twice a week. That's all there is. We're going to be hungry, but nothing's worse than being caught. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, May 26, 1944. My dearest Kitty, at long, long last, I can sit quietly at my table before the crack in the window frame and write you everything, everything I want to say. I feel more miserable than I have in months. Even after the break-in, I didn't feel so utterly broken inside and out. On the one hand, there's the news about Mr. Van Hoven. The Jewish question, which is discussed in detail by everyone in the house. The invasion, which is so long in coming. The awful food, the tension, the miserable atmosphere, my disappointment in Peter. On the other hand, there's Bep's engagement, the Pentecost reception, the flowers, Mr. Kugler's birthday, cakes, and stories about cabarets, movies, and concerts. That gap, that enormous gap, is always there. One day we're laughing at the comical side of life in hiding, and the next day, and there are many such days, we're frightened, and the fear, tension, and despair can be read on our faces. Miep and Mr. Kugler bear the greatest burden for us and for all those in hiding. Miep and everything she does, and Mr. Kugler through his enormous responsibility for the eight of us, which is sometimes so overwhelming that he can hardly speak from the pent-up tension and strain. Mr. Kleiman and Bep also take good care of us, but they're able to put the annex out of their minds, even if it's only for a few hours or a few days. They have their own worries, Mr. Kleiman with his health and Bep with her engagement, which isn't looking very promising at the moment. But they also have their outings, their visits with friends, their everyday lives as ordinary people, so that the tension is sometimes relieved, if only for a short while ours never is, never has been, not once in the 2 years we've been here. How much longer will this increasingly oppressive, unbearable weight press down on us? The drains are clogged again. We can't run the water, or if we do, only a trickle. We can't flush the toilet, so we have to use a toilet brush. And we've been putting our dirty water into a big earthenware jar. We can manage for today, but what will happen if the plumber can't fix it on his own? The sanitation department can't come until Tuesday. Miep sent us a raisin bread with Happy Pentecost written on top. It's almost as if she were mocking us, since our moods and cares are far from happy. We've all become more frightened since the Van Hoven business. Once again, you hear, shh, from all sides, and we're doing everything more quietly. The police forced the door there. They could just as easily do that here, too. What will we do if we're ever... No. I mustn't write that down. But the question won't let itself be pushed to the back of my mind today. On the contrary, all the fear I've ever felt is looming before me in all its horror. I had to go downstairs alone at 8 this evening to use the bathroom. There was no one down there since they were all listening to the radio. I wanted to be brave, but it was hard. I always feel safer upstairs than in that huge silent house. When I'm alone with those mysterious muffled sounds from upstairs and the honking of horns in the street, I have to hurry and remind myself where I am to keep from getting the shivers. Miep has been acting much nicer toward us since her talk with Father. But I haven't told you about that yet. Miep came up one afternoon all flushed and asked Father straight out if we thought they too were infected with the current anti-Semitism. Father was stunned and quickly talked her out of the idea. But some of Miep's suspicion has lingered on. They're doing more errands for us now and showing more of an interest in our troubles, though we certainly shouldn't bother them with our woes. Oh, they're such good, noble people. I've asked myself again and again whether it wouldn't have been better if we hadn't gone into hiding, if we were dead now and didn't have to go through this misery, especially so that the others could be spared the burden. But we all shrink from this thought. We still love life. We haven't yet forgotten the voice of nature, and we keep hoping. Hoping for everything. Let something happen soon. Even an air raid. Nothing can be more crushing than this anxiety. Let the end come, however cruel. At least then we'll know whether we are to be the victors or the vanquished. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Wednesday, May 31st, 1944. Dearest Kitty, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, it was too hot to hold my fountain pen, which is why I couldn't write to you. Friday, the drains were clogged. Saturday, they were fixed. Mrs. Kleiman came for a visit in the afternoon and told us a lot about Jopie. She and Jacques Van Marsen are in the same hockey club. Sunday, Bep dropped by to make sure there hadn't been a break-in and stayed for breakfast. Monday, a holiday because of Pentecost, Mr. Guise served as the annex watchman. And Tuesday, we were finally allowed to open the windows. We've seldom had a Pentecost weekend that was so beautiful and warm. Or maybe hot is a better word. Hot weather is horrible in the annex. To give you an idea of the numerous complaints, I'll briefly describe these sweltering days. Saturday. Wonderful! What fantastic weather, we all said in the morning. If only it weren't quite so hot, we said in the afternoon when the windows had to be shut. Sunday. The heat's unbearable. The butter's melting. There's not a cool spot anywhere in the house. The bread's drying out. The milk's going sour. The windows can't be opened. We poor outcasts are suffocating while everyone else is enjoying their Pentecost, according to Mrs. Van D. Monday. My feet hurt. I have nothing cool to wear. I can't do the dishes in this heat. Grumbling from early in the morning to late at night. It was awful. I can't stand the heat. I'm glad the winds come up today, but that the sun's still shining. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, June 2nd, 1944. Dear Kitty, if you're going to the attic, take an umbrella with you, preferably a large one. This is to protect you from household showers. There's a Dutch proverb, high and dry, safe and sound. But it obviously doesn't apply to wartime, guns, and to people in hiding, cat box. Mushi's gotten into the habit of relieving herself on some newspapers or between the cracks in the floorboards, so we have good reason to fear the splatters and, even worse, the stench. The new Morcha in the warehouse has the same problem. Anyone who's ever had a cat that's not housebroken can imagine the smells, other than pepper and thyme, that permeate this house. I also have a brand new prescription for gunfire jitters. When the shooting gets loud, proceed to the nearest wooden staircase. Run up and down a few times, making sure to stumble at least once. What with the scratches and the noise of running and falling, you won't even be able to hear the shooting, much less worry about it. Yours truly has put this magic formula to use with great success. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Monday, June 5th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, new problems in the annex. A quarrel between Dussel and the Franks over the division of butter. Capitulation on the part of Dussel. Close friendship between the latter and Mrs. Van Dan. Flirtations, kisses, and friendly little smiles. Dussel is beginning to long for female companionship. The Van Dans don't see why we should bake a spice cake for Mr. Kugler's birthday when we can't have one ourselves. All very petty. Mood upstairs, bad. Mrs. Van D has a cold. Dussel caught with brewer's yeast tablets while we've got none. The Fifth Army has taken Rome. The city neither destroyed nor bombed. Great propaganda for Hitler. Very few potatoes and vegetables. One loaf of bread was moldy. Charminskels, name of the new warehouse cat, can't stand pepper. She sleeps in the cat box and does her business in the wood shavings. Impossible to keep her. Bad weather. Continuous bombing of Pas-de-Calais and the west coast of France. No one buying dollars. Gold even less interesting. The bottom of our black money box is in sight. What are we going to live on next month? Yours, Anne M. Frank. Tuesday, June 6, 1944. My dearest Kitty, this is D-Day, the BBC announced at 12. This is the day the invasion has begun. This morning at 8, the British reported heavy bombing of Calais, Boulogne, Le Havre, and Cherbourg, as well as Pas-de-Calais, as usual. Further, as a precautionary measure for those in the occupied territories, everyone living within a zone of 20 miles from the coast was warned to prepare for bombardments. Where possible, the British will drop pamphlets an hour ahead of time. According to the German news, British paratroopers have landed on the coast of France. British landing craft are engaged in combat with German naval units, according to the BBC. Conclusion reached by the annex while breakfasting at 9? This is a trial landing, like the one 2 years ago in Dieppe. BBC broadcast in German, Dutch, French, and other languages at 10. The invasion has begun. So this is the real invasion. BBC broadcast in German at 11. Speech by Supreme Commander General Dwight Eisenhower. BBC broadcast in English. This is D-Day, General Eisenhower said to the French people. Stiff fighting will come now, but after this, the victory. The year 1944 is the year of complete victory. Good luck. BBC broadcast in English at 1. 11,000 planes are shuttling back and forth or standing by to land troops and bomb behind enemy lines. 4,000 landing craft and small boats are continually arriving in the area between Cherbourg and Le Havre. English and American troops are already engaged in heavy combat. Speeches by Gerbrandy, the Prime Minister of Belgium, King Haakon of Norway, De Gaulle of France, the King of England, and last but not least, Churchill. A huge commotion in the annex. Is this really the beginning of the long-awaited liberation? The liberation we've all talked so much about, which still seems too good, too much of a fairy tale ever to come true. Will this year, 1944, bring us victory? We don't know yet. But where there's hope, there's life. It fills us with fresh courage and makes us strong again. We'll need to be brave to endure the many fears and hardships and the suffering yet to come. It's now a matter of remaining calm and steadfast, of gritting our teeth and keeping a stiff upper lip. France, Russia, Italy, and even Germany can cry out in agony, but we don't yet have that right. Oh, Kitty, the best part about the invasion is that I have the feeling that friends are on the way. Those terrible Germans have oppressed and threatened us for so long that the thought of friends and salvation means everything to us. Now it's not just the Jews, but Holland and all of occupied Europe. Maybe, Margot says, I can even go back to school in October or September. Yours, Anne M. Frank. P.S. I'll keep you informed of the latest news. This morning and last night, dummies made of straw and rubber were dropped from the air behind the German lines, and they exploded the minute they hit the ground. Many paratroopers, their faces blackened so they couldn't be seen in the dark, landed as well. The French coast was bombarded with 5,500 tons of bombs during the night, and then at 6 in the morning, the first landing craft came ashore. Today, there were 20,000 airplanes in action. The German coastal batteries were destroyed even before the landing. A small bridgehead has already been formed. Everything's going well despite the bad weather. The army and the people are one will and one hope. Friday, June 9th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, great news of the invasion. The Allies have taken Bayeux, a village on the coast of France, and are now fighting for Caen. They're clearly intending to cut off the peninsula where Cherbourg is located. Every evening, the war correspondents report on the difficulties, the courage, and the fighting spirit of the army. To get their stories, they pull off the most amazing feats. A few of the wounded who are already back in England also spoke on the radio. Despite the miserable weather, the planes are flying diligently back and forth. We heard over the BBC that Churchill wanted to land along with the troops on D-Day, but Eisenhower and other generals managed to talk him out of it. Just imagine, so much courage for such an old man. He must be at least 70. The excitement here has died down somewhat. Still, we're all hoping that the war will finally be over by the end of the year. It's about time. Mrs. Van Dan's constant griping is unbearable. Now that she can no longer drive us crazy with the invasion, she moans and groans all day about the bad weather. If only we could plunk her down in the loft in a bucket of cold water. Everyone in the annex, except Mr. Van Dan and Peter, has read the Hungarian Rhapsody Trilogy, a biography of the composer, piano virtuoso, and child prodigy Franz Liszt. It's very interesting, though in my opinion there's a bit too much emphasis on women. Liszt was not only the greatest and most famous pianist of his time, he was also the biggest womanizer, even at the age of 70. He had an affair with Countess Marie Diagol, Princess Caroline Sein Wittgenstein, the dancer Lola Montez, the pianist Agnes Kingsworth, the pianist Sophie Mentor, the Circassian princess Olga Janina, Baroness Olga Mayendorf, actress Lila What's-Her-Name, etc., etc., and there's no end to it. Those parts of the book dealing with music and other arts are much more interesting. Some of the people mentioned are Schumann, Clara Wieck, Hector Berlioz, Johannes Brahms, Beethoven, Joachim, Richard Wagner, Hans von Bülow, Anton Rubinstein, Frédéric Chopin, Victor Hugo, Honoré de Balzac, Hiller, Hummel, Czerny, Rossini, Cherubini, Paganini, Mendelssohn, etc., etc. Liszt appears to have been a decent man, very generous and modest, though exceptionally vain. He helped others, put art above all else, and was extremely fond of cognac and women. Couldn't bear the sight of tears, was a gentleman, couldn't refuse anyone a favor, wasn't interested in money, and cared about religious freedom and the world. Yours, Anne M. Frank.
Повторим еще раз вовек хранимые буквы Залехес. Повторим еще раз вовек хранимые.
Tuesday, June 13th, 1944. Dearest Kit, another birthday has gone by, so I'm now 15. I received quite a few gifts. Springer's 5-volume art history book, a set of underwear, 2 belts, a handkerchief, 2 jars of yogurt, a jar of jam, 2 honey cookies, small, a botany book from father and mother, a gold bracelet from Margot, a sticker album from the Van Dans, biomalt and sweet peas from Dussel, candy from Miep, candy and notebooks from Bep, and the high point, the book Maria Teresa, and 3 slices of full cream cheese from Mr. Kugler. Peter gave me a lovely bouquet of peonies. The poor boy had put a lot of effort into finding a present, but nothing quite worked out. The invasion is still going splendidly, in spite of the miserable weather, pouring rains, gale winds, and high seas. Yesterday, Churchill, Smuts, Eisenhower, and Arnold visited the French villages that the British have captured and liberated. Churchill was on a torpedo boat that shelled the coast. Like many men, he doesn't seem to know what fear is, an enviable trait. From our position here in Fort Annex, it's difficult to gauge the mood of the Dutch. No doubt many people are glad the idle British have finally rolled up their sleeves and gotten down to work. Those who keep claiming they don't want to be occupied by the British don't realize how unfair they're being. Their line of reasoning boils down to this. England must fight, struggle, and sacrifice its sons to liberate Holland and the other occupied countries. After that, the British shouldn't remain in Holland. They should offer their most abject apologies to all the occupied countries, restore the Dutch East Indies to its rightful owner, and then return, weakened and impoverished, to England. What a bunch of idiots! And yet, as I've already said, many Dutch people can be counted among their ranks. What would have become of Holland and its neighbors if England had signed a peace treaty with Germany, as it's had ample opportunity to do? Holland would have become German, and that would have been the end of that. All those Dutch people who still look down on the British, scoff at England and its government of old fogies, call the English cowards, yet hate the Germans, should be given a good shaking, the way you'd plump up a pillow. Maybe that would straighten out their jumbled brains. Wishes, thoughts, accusations, and reproaches are swirling around in my head. I'm not really as conceited as many people think. I know my various faults and shortcomings better than anyone else, but there's one difference. I also know that I want to change, will change, and already have changed greatly. Why is it, I often ask myself, that everyone still thinks I'm so pushy and such a know-it-all? Am I really so arrogant? Am I the one who's so arrogant, or are they? It sounds crazy, I know, but I'm not going to cross out that last sentence because it's not as crazy as it seems. Mrs. Van Dan and Dussel, my two chief accusers, are known to be totally unintelligent and, not to put too fine a point on it, just plain stupid. Stupid people usually can't bear it when others do something better than they do. The best examples of this are those two dummies, Mrs. Van Dan and Dussel. Mrs. Van D thinks I'm stupid because I don't suffer so much from this ailment as she does. She thinks I'm pushy because she's even pushier. She thinks my dresses are too short because hers are even shorter. And she thinks I'm such a know-it-all because she talks twice as much as I do about topics she knows nothing about. The same goes for Dussel, but one of my favorite sayings is, where there's smoke, there's fire. And I readily admit I'm a know-it-all. What's so difficult about my personality is that I scold and curse myself much more than anyone else does. If Mother adds her advice, the pile of sermons becomes so thick that I despair of ever getting through them. Then I talk back and start contradicting everyone until the old familiar Anne refrain inevitably crops up. No one understands me. This phrase is part of me, and as unlikely as it may seem, there's a kernel of truth in it. Sometimes I'm so deeply buried under self-reproaches that I long for a word of comfort to help me dig myself out again. If only I had someone who took my feelings seriously. Alas, I haven't yet found that person, so the search must go on. I know you're wondering about Peter, aren't you, Kit? It's true. Peter loves me, not as a girlfriend, but as a friend. His affection grows day by day. But some mysterious force is holding us back, and I don't know what it is. Sometimes I think my terrible longing for him was over-exaggerated. But that's not true, because if I'm unable to go to his room for a day or two, I long for him as desperately as I ever did. Peter is kind and good, and yet I can't deny that he's disappointed me in many ways. I especially don't care for his dislike of religion, his table conversations, and various things of that nature. Still, I'm firmly convinced that we'll stick to our agreement never to quarrel. Peter is peace-loving, tolerant, and extremely easygoing. He lets me say a lot of things to him that he'd never accept from his mother. He's making a determined effort to remove the blots from his copybook and keep his affairs in order. Yet, why does he hide his innermost self and never allow me access? Of course, he's much more closed than I am. But I know from experience, even though I'm constantly being accused of knowing all there is to know in theory, but not in practice, that in time, even the most uncommunicative types will long as much, or even more, for someone to confide in. Peter and I have spent our contemplative years in the annex. We often discuss the future, the past, and the present. But as I've already told you, I miss the real thing, and yet I know it exists. Is it because I haven't been outdoors for so long that I've become so smitten with nature? I remember a time when a magnificent blue sky, chirping birds, moonlight, and budding blossoms wouldn't have captivated me. Things have changed since I came here. One night during the Pentecost holiday, for instance, when it was so hot, I struggled to keep my eyes open until 11:30 so I could get a good look at the moon, all on my own for once. Alas, my sacrifice was in vain, since there was too much glare and I couldn't risk opening a window. Another time several months ago, I happened to be upstairs one night when the window was open. I didn't go back down until it had to be closed again. The dark, rainy evening, the wind, the racing clouds had me spellbound. It was the first time in a year and a half that I'd seen the night face to face. After that evening, my longing to see it again was even greater than my fear of burglars, a dark rat-infested house, or robberies. I went downstairs all by myself and looked out the windows in the kitchen and private office. Many people think nature is beautiful, Many people sleep from time to time under the starry sky, and many people in hospitals or prisons long for the day when they'll be free to enjoy what nature has to offer. But few are as isolated and cut off as we are from the joys of nature, which can be shared by rich and poor alike. It's not just my imagination. Looking at the sky, the clouds, the moon, and the stars really does make me feel calm and hopeful. It's much better medicine than valerian or bromide. Nature makes me feel humble and ready to face every blow with courage. As luck would have it, I'm only able, except for a few rare occasions, to view nature through dusty curtains tacked over dirt-caked windows. It takes the pleasure out of looking. Nature is the one thing for which there is no substitute. One of the many questions that have often bothered me is why women have been, and still are, thought to be so inferior to men. It's easy to say it's unfair, but that's not enough for me. I'd really like to know the reason for this great injustice. Men presumably dominated women from the very beginning because of their greater physical strength. It's men who earn a living, beget children, and do as they please. Until recently, women silently went along with this, which was stupid, since the longer it's kept up, the more deeply entrenched it becomes. Fortunately, education, work, and progress have opened women's eyes. In many countries, they've been granted equal rights. Many people, mainly women, but also men, now realize how wrong it was to tolerate this state of affairs for so long. Modern women want the right to be completely independent. But that's not all. Women should be respected as well. Generally speaking, men are held in great esteem in all parts of the world. So why shouldn't women have their share? Soldiers and war heroes are honored and commemorated. Explorers are granted immortal fame. Martyrs are revered. But how many people look upon women, too, as soldiers? In the book, Soldiers on the Home Front, I was greatly struck by the fact that in childbirth alone, women commonly suffer more pain, illness, and misery than any war hero ever does. And what's her reward for enduring all this pain? She gets pushed aside when she's disfigured by birth. Her children soon leave. Her beauty is gone. Women who struggle and suffer pain to ensure the continuation of the human race make much tougher and more courageous soldiers than all those big-mouthed freedom-fighting heroes put together. I don't mean to imply that women should stop having children. On the contrary, nature intended them to, and that's the way it should be. What I condemn are our system of values and the men who don't acknowledge how great, difficult, but ultimately beautiful women's share in society is. I agree completely with Paul de Kruijf, the author of this book, when he says that men must learn that birth is no longer thought of as inevitable and unavoidable in those parts of the world we consider civilized. It's easy for men to talk. They don't and never will have to bear the woes that women do. I believe that in the course of the next century, the notion that it's a woman's duty to have children will change and make way for the respect and admiration of all women who bear their burdens without complaint or a lot of pompous words. Yours, Anne M. Frank.
That's all the time we have for today's reading from Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. Join us at the same time next week. Thanks again for listening. If you know someone who could benefit from our service, point them our direction. If you know someone who would like to contribute in any way, point them in our direction. You can call us at 919-832-5138 or visit our website at trianglereadingservice.org. Once again, I'm Randy Wasserstrom. From Susie, from me, and everyone here at TRRS, have a nice rest of the day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.